But in any event, of that total, $4 billion of that isn't even going to be in cash. $4 billion of the total settlement is in thermoform homeowner relief. That can include things like short sales on securities that they sold, things the bank doesn't even own. So, and we saw in the national mortgage settlement, the big one we had at the beginning of last year, that most of that has been things that really haven't involved any real damage to the banks. The portion that's paying for the hamburger instead of steak part is going to be tax deductible. And it looks like there's another fight that's going on between the Department of Justice and J.P. Morgan that they may be able to put $1.1 billion of that total amount to the FDIC. So the actual number that J.P. Morgan is going to wind up paying is vastly smaller than this number that's being bandied about.
Eve Smith, we have to stop this conversation here for the end of the show, but we'll continue it online and we'll post it at democracynow.org. Eve Smith, financial analyst who founded the popular finance blog Naked Capitalism, author of Econed. And that does it for our show. If you'd like to get a copy, go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkner, Nafel Saramate, Nirmin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Masood, Robbie Karen, Dina Gester, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is more talk radio with hosts Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey. Today's guest is psychologist Tony Greenwald, co-author of the book Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People.
KBFA brings the listening public the other point of view.
There was a strong sense that this was the beginning of something that would spread across the country.
On Sunday, November 3rd, at the historic Hollywood Theater, KBOO presents an exclusive benefit screening of the film KPFA On the Air.
This documentary tells the powerful story of the beginnings of listener-sponsored radio in the United States with the birth of Pacifica in Berkeley in 1949.
KPFA On the Air chronicles the origins of the free speech movement, the first stirrings of the student movements at Berkeley, and opposition to the Vietnam War in the early 1960s.
Eventually spawning a network of free-form, independent radio stations across the country, including KBOO, which came on the air in 1968. So come join us at the Hollywood Theater, Northeast 41st and Sandy Boulevard, Sunday, November 3rd, at 7 in the evening.
Help keep community radio strong and thriving into the future.
Muertos Northwest invites you to the 5th annual Dia de los Muertos celebration, Saturday, November 2nd, at the Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street, Portland, under the Hawthorne Bridge. Celebration of life and death. Come help the spirits of your loved ones return with their favorite food, drinks, and plenty of dancing. Bring an item to add to the community altar. Muertos face painting for the young and old, sugar skull decorating, hot chocolate and pan dulce will be served. Come check out Mariachi Portland, Conjunto Alegre, and Rafa and the Deadliest Catch Band. Come for the Muertos, stay for the food. Food, drinks, and dancing. Sponsored in part by KBOO, Tequila Cuervo, and Cover Oregon. Visit Facebook Muertos Northwest.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You are listening to KBOO-FM. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott.
My name is Celeste Carey, and you are listening to your community connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM here in the Portland metro area. If you are in Points East, it's 91.9. Points South, it's 104.3. And on the web, it is www.kboo.fm.
And so let me give you a phone number so you can call us a little bit later as we enter into our conversation with our guest this morning, hoping that you will participate. So give us a call at 503-231-8187. And you can also email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. Celeste, do you want to introduce our audience about our topic and guest this morning?
Well, let me see if I can pull this together here, because for some reason it seems to be hanging around in my blind spot. What we're going to talk about today is a blind spot, but not literally, not the one that resides in your eye and obscures things that are right in your line of vision, but more of things that are in your mind and obscure some of your choices, some of your motivations, some of your intentions for the behaviors and activities that you indulge in, I indulge in, human beings indulge in. We're going to be speaking today with Anthony G. Greenwald. He is one of the collaborators of the book Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People. And along with Mazarin Banerjee, Anthony Greenwald helped put together a book that is to help us look at what makes us act in the ways we do. They are co-developers of the implicit association test. And this is a method that they said both transfer them, their work, and even the field of inquiry. And we're hoping that today it will give you an opportunity to transform yourself. So without further ado, let me introduce Anthony Greenwald, known as Tony. Good morning, Tony. I'm assuming if you're still on the West Coast this morning, right?
Yes, I'm north of you in Seattle.
Right.
Sun's out here. Hope you've got it, too.
Well, we've got a little bit of it. We figured we'll start the day with it. Who knows? Who knows? But first, thank you for taking time out of your day to meet with us. And first, could you tell us just a little bit about yourself and how you and Professor Banerjee got together to work on this particular field of study and come out with such an I guess I'll call it insightful, you know, both in terms of a pun and literally, test and process.
I'll be glad to, Celeste. And first, let me just congratulate you on the pronunciation of Mazarin Banerjee's name, which many people stumble over. She's a native Indian from India who is now a professor at Harvard, worked with me as a PhD student when I was still at Ohio State. I am now at University of Washington, where I've been for over a quarter of a century, and I'm a social psychologist trained at as an undergraduate at Yale, as got my PhD at Harvard, and I've been teaching and doing research ever since. Okay, so much for my background. You asked how we got together on this. We are sort of riding on the wave of what is a revolution in our field of psychology. And it's a revolution that isn't yet widely known, but has had tremendous impact on psychological research and theory. And it's built on the idea that the mind typically operates at two levels. I sometimes call them level one and level two, although we don't use those terms in the book. But the higher level, level one, is the level at which we actually think we are operating most of the day. It's our conscious awareness, intentional, deliberate, thoughtful, rational behavior. And we like to make judgments thoughtfully, rationally, and act on them. And this is the level at which our intentions reside. If any of your listeners had read Daniel Kahneman's book called Thinking Fast and Slow, this is the thinking slow level. Kahneman is the psychologist who won a Nobel Prize in economics about 10 years ago for his work. Okay, so that was level one. Level two, and I'll end this quickly so you can proceed to other things. Level two is the unthinking level, and this is the level about that is of most concern in blind spot. It's a level where we do things more automatically, impulsively, without thinking. And basically, we do anything that is well-learned, familiar, and practiced at this level without thinking too much about it. An example for those who drive is that if you're driving a familiar route, you may proceed along much of it without much awareness of actually what's going on, thinking about what you're doing. You may forget whether passed a red light or a green light at some particular intersection, and even whether you stopped at a stop sign or not. But in fact, level two works well enough so that you actually generally do stop at a stop sign. And it's at level two that we do things that sometimes deviate from our intentions, because level two operates by using and applying the familiar, and sometimes the familiar doesn't coincide with what we would like to think, believe, or do.
You're listening to KBOO-FM. Our guest this morning is Professor Tony Greenwald, who is the co-author of Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People. We're speaking about two levels of consciousness. And as you share that introduction, Tony, I'm wondering, as we try to negotiate between this level one and level two, certainly your research revealed to us that we are often unaware of how we might act, assuming that our intentions are known to us and that we act as we ought to act. I understand that, you know, you created some tests around this. It's the implicit association test that helps uncover some of our hidden biases. Is that correct?
Yes. And this was about a little more than 15 years ago. In my laboratory at University of Washington, while working on a project that Mazarine Banaji and I were working on together, she was then at Yale University, I developed this method, which proved to be tremendously productive in providing a window into what we call very simply associations, which are connections between things in our head that can be revealed by a fairly simple test. It takes about 5 minutes to take, and it can be taken on the internet. We should give a site later for your listeners to find it. It's been taken about 15 million times in the past 15 years since it's been on the internet, and there are a number of varieties of it, about 14 of them presently available on our internet site. And the ones that get the most interest are ones that have to do with race and gender. Now, level two you can call it a level of consciousness, because we are actually aware of what level two is doing. We're just not thinking about it and controlling it actively, intentionally, and deliberately, but doing it automatically.
So, but you would still differentiate it between the autonomic responses that a lot of people associate unconscious with, though, correct?
I think you said autonomic.
I'm saying that you differentiate them. Yes.
It is partly automatic, but it isn't totally outside of consciousness. As one can see when doing the implicit association test. Now, I can say a little bit about that, but I'm not sure we're ready to go there yet.
No, not quite yet. Almost. And so, one of the reasons I asked for about differentiation is because you mentioned that we're partially conscious of it. So I want people to understand that to a degree we do we do intentionally tap into this database, if you will, of feeling and knowledge. But it's just not something that we hold in our mind. Like we consciously choose that we want tea instead of coffee, for example.
Let me give you an example. And we give this example fairly early in the book Blind Spot. The question you are asked most frequently and to which you give an automatic answer, if you're anything like me, is, how are you?
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to say?
I'm going to think about it and say I'm fine.
Fine, yeah. And you'll say that regardless of how you actually feel. This is more or less an automatic response. It's not mm-hmm. outside of consciousness. I mean, you're aware you're talking, you're aware you're answering a question, but you're giving a response that you give pretty automatically to that situation, which is a very frequent interaction situation. You may currently have a headache. You may be starving. You may be annoyed at something that just happened. But you walk by a coworker or a friend who says, how are you? And you say, fine.
Well,
level two.
Another example you use early on that begins to enter into a lot of what you go into the book is the question, do I look fat in these blue jeans? and our response, we want to be good people. So how do we respond normally, and what does that say about us?
That's not so much level two. This is in a chapter in the book in which we're talking about how often people actually give verbal answers to questions when they know the answer isn't quite correct. And it's not you asking yourself, how fat do I look in these jeans? It's someone else wearing those jeans, asking you and how you respond. And you may have a number of thoughts about this that run through your head, and the one you choose for an answer may not necessarily be your most honest response.
So what we do is we sift. But one of the things that I want to get at is the fact that this repository, if you will, of where we keep this information, it's not often something that we may tap into it, but it's not necessarily someplace that we very deliberately walk over mentally and get into. And one of the reasons why your book is so significant is that it reveals that the behavior we have may not line up with who we think we are all of the time and catch us by surprise. And so the reference of Blind Spot, you're talking about kind of this area of impulse formed on ideas and thoughts and conclusions we've come to, but we're just not always wholly conscious that we've come to them. And you call them mind bugs. Can you kind of expand on that a little bit for us?
Yeah, the things we talk about are as mind bugs, some of which we illustrate in the book with visual allusions, are actually things that happen automatically outside of awareness, usually not so much in conscious awareness, and end up producing behavior or judgments that we actually don't agree with. Let me give an example of the way the IAT works. I'm not going to go into detail on it. I actually encourage people to try it themselves. I will give the website for it. It's implicit.harvard.edu, which you can go to. But one of the ones that's very widely used is one in which we measure an association of male and female with family and career.
Mm-hmm.
And the typical response is that everyone, and I mean everyone, both men and women, well, I actually don't quite mean everyone, but I mean about 80-85% of people, show a strong association of male with career and female with family, and it affects their performance on the implicit association test, I may call it the IAT, which is the way it's now known in psychology, it affects their performance by enabling them to perform rapidly when they're obliged to give the same response to female names and words referring to family, or male names and words referring to career, but much slower when we reverse the task, as the IAT does, and they have to give the same response to female names and words referring to career. This is an association that has been established in our heads by our culture. Strangely, it's established a little more strongly in the heads of women than men, but it's pretty strong in both. And this often is something that we don't consciously agree with. Many people are surprised when they take an IAT that shows them they have these what we call gender stereotype associations firmly implanted in their heads, even though they don't endorse the stereotype at all.
You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. We're speaking with Professor Tony Greenwald, who is the co-author of the book, Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People. And file the phone number back in your seeing spot, if you will, at 503-231-8187. We'll be opening up the phone lines here in just a moment. So to kind of help people, those who may be still scratching their head and saying what, there was a riddle that was offered that kind of helps explain how we, and especially Americans, United States citizens, with our culture and our inculcation of gender roles, that kind of helps explain it. And it says that a father and son were riding in a car in a car accident. Father was killed. Son goes to the hospital. Surgeon on the table looks at the child and says, "I can't operate. That's my son." And so the answer to the riddle depends on, or rather is kind of like a mini IAT. Is that correct?
It actually demonstrates a mind bug. Now, your listeners may have been helped by the fact that we were just talking about.
Oh, yeah, and I'm hoping they were helped.
And so maybe they guessed the answer to the riddle. How can this possibly be? Do you want to reveal it?
Well, the answer is that the surgeon is a woman.
The mother.
And the funny thing is, the first time I heard it, and I don't know what this says, I thought woman. And I don't know why, and I'm happy. But by the same token, it's not necessarily an ordinary thought, and it might have something to do with some of the roles I have, which was also cadet in the military. So, you know, there are certain things that I think of that might be slightly different than the ordinary. But you talked about how that test reveals a mind bug, and can you explain just a little bit more? And then we want to talk about the test and how you developed it.
Yeah, the... it's a mind bug. The term mind bug originates from some studies done by a computer scientist several decades ago, looking at how children learn arithmetic, particularly the task of carrying numbers in multi-digit subtractions when you have to subtract a number in which the digit that you're subtracting is larger than the digit from which you are subtracting. You have to add 10 above, and you know how to do it. And children, when they do it, get caught and will frequently make errors on this until they learn it automatically enough. And at the point in which it's causing errors, it's called a mind bug because it actually produces behavior that you don't want. And does it with sort of outside your mental control because you haven't really automated and practiced enough the habits that needed to overcome it. Now, the gender stereotypes can be mind bugs because they can be applied in thinking about people, in judging people, and in people judging themselves. And this is the way we talk about it. We talk about it in all of these ways in the book. When one is considering applicants for a leadership position in a company, and there are men and women applicants, people who want to be open to treat everyone with equal opportunity and entirely fairly will nevertheless have this these associations, these gender stereotype associations in their heads, telling them, well, you know, woman, family, she's probably going to need to spend some time at home, not be able to put in as many hours on the job. And this may be something, and actually often is something, that removes women from top consideration for jobs for which they are fully qualified.
And as you suggest, in terms of how we act, people are often motivated by good intentions. So we have these hidden biases, perhaps, and even though we want to do what we believe are the correct things, we might have those aha moments where we discover that there is something that lies deep within us, which prevent us from responding how we think we ought to, or how we think we would respond. But you also suggest, and I believe, is that sometimes this self-deception is not meant to do harm, but to do good. Could you expand a little bit about that in terms of sometimes the prejudice we might have or the form of discrimination might not be to do harm, but to be helpful.
Kind of like it runs amok of our need to categorize, I think, and figure out, okay, I have a little bit of time, and you think I need to help this person. Like in your book, I think you mentioned writing a letter to benefit somebody. So I think if I'm hearing you right, Cecil, you're talking about how when we're trying to do something good for people, Tony, the mind bug will kind of blindside us, if you will, and it will, instead of us doing the right thing to benefit somebody, we'll find ourselves doing something that kind of is self-serving or serving our particular group or demographic. Is that it, Cecil?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Cecil.
I'm just trying to expand in terms of, because sometimes I want to do the right thing. And I'm unaware that I have these feelings or attitudes within myself. So popularly, we think of stereotyping as very bad, wanting to do harm to that group, to that gender, to that that racial group. But sometimes it's not meant that way. Those blind spots are motivated by good motives, maybe?
Well, let me give one example that we give in the book, which I think is very compelling in indicating the way we can operate somewhat on automatic, meaning level two that I was referring to before, mm-hmm. and do behaviors, make judgments, do actions that are entirely praiseworthy, yet end up having some kind of unintended discriminatory effect. The example we give is one that Mahzarin Banaji told me about at first. Mm-hmm. It was when she was at Yale, yes. and a colleague of hers was cleaning, washing dishes in her kitchen, trying to clean a large glass bowl. The bowl slipped, cracked. She tried to catch it, and when she tried to catch it, she gashed her hand. Mm-hmm. Now, she's a quilter. The gash was obviously needed stitches, so she took herself, she and her boyfriend took themselves to Yale New Haven Hospital. She was at Yale, and to the emergency room, where the resident at the emergency room looked at the injury and said, hold on just a second, we'll get this stitched up soon. Mm-hmm. And the boyfriend points out, you know, she's a quilter. We're looking at things that may, you know, she may have damaged some nerve. This may cause problems with her quilting. Doesn't it need more attention than stitches? The resident says, no, we can stitch this up, and we'll take care of it soon. A few minutes passes. In the emergency room, an aide who is an undergraduate at Yale says, oh, hello, Professor Kaplan, referring to the woman whose hand has been gashed. And immediately, the resident's behavior changes. He's, you know, sort of does a double take and says, oh, I'm going to call up to surgery and we'll have this looked at. She is sent up a few floors to surgery. A plastic surgeon is called in to operate on her hand. The operation takes 2 hours or so, and everything is fine. Mm-hmm. Okay, what happened here? What happened was, okay, did anything bad get done? No. Mm-hmm. In fact, the resident ended up doing clearly a big favor, getting special care for this injury, and it all worked out well, and there was no apparent discrimination involved. But what caused it was the resident's putting this patient into a new category.
Mm-hmm.
Category was, you know, sort of walk-in, somewhat grungy-looking woman who'd just been cleaning dishes, and that was the original category. And that got revised into Yale professor, and, you know, this is Yale New Haven Hospital. So immediately this woman went into a different category, and what happened? She got extra special treatment. Now, the question is, okay, how does this cause discrimination? The question is, who would get this special care? Will everyone get it? And I think the answer that we can all see is no. Something has to happen to lead to getting this kind of special care. It's my hypothesis that this is actually at the basis of a phenomenon, or it's one of the important types of bases for a phenomenon that we call healthcare disparities, where when you do surveys and study healthcare and health status of various groups, you find that lower socioeconomic classes, sometimes racial minorities or ethnic minorities, have poorer health status than others who have exactly the same type of insurance and should be getting just as much health care. So just to end this story already too long, quickly, it's how a person's membership in a category can cause some favoritism, some helpful behavior that wouldn't otherwise occur. And discrimination can be caused just as much by help that is selectively allocated as by harm that is selectively allocated.
And I was wondering, since you told that story, I also read that in, you know, hearing a story like that is often a aha moment for people. I read that after hearing this story, one of your relatives decided to do something about that. Is that correct?
In terms
of donating.
It was not the exactly that story, but it was a similar sort of situation. Mm-hmm. I think we tell this story, I'm not giving away identities, but about a woman mm-hmm. who is in the situation of attending a major reunion of her college class and asked to give a contribution, as reunion groups always do. And she was, you know, trying to dig deep and give a large gift and realized that although her college that she was giving it to was entirely open to all admissions and encouraged equal opportunity, it was still 80-85% white school, so she's giving her money to a school that is going to end up spending it more on whites than on others. And after realizing this, she decided, well, okay, I can deal with this not by denying my gift to the school, but just by giving another gift that will help others. And so she gave an equal gift to the United Negro College Fund, which I thought was remarkably an insightful response.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. We invite your questions to call us and to share with us some of the examples you've discovered of your own blind spots. And then we want to offer people the opportunity to take the test. You can go online, take the test. You can buy the book and take the test and share the test with other people. But more importantly, you can get a glimpse into yourself and to see how you respond. You may find that, again, if we've mentioned, there are some attitudes you have that don't line up with who you think you are. And you may find that to be both illuminating and or disturbing. But give us a call, 503-231-8187. So, Tony, we spent a lot of time trying to get this test in context. Tell us how you came about creating this test and how you were able to adjust it for some of the pitfalls that would come out of the mind of one who lives in the world trying to get an objective view of the world.
Well, Mazarin Banaji and I were in the early 1990s trying to apply some ideas that were coming out of the part of psychology that we call cognitive psychology, the study of memory, showing automatic processes happening in memory. And we were thinking, you know, this work, this has application to our field of social psychology, the study of attitudes and stereotypes. How can we do it? We had to find a method that could allow us to measure the things that would represent the social operation of the kinds of automatic processes that memory researchers had started demonstrating in the middle 1980s. And so we looked around thinking about various possibilities. We wrote a research grant application to the National Science Foundation, which had about half a dozen possibilities suggested in it. And amidst this grant application was one paragraph describing an experimental task that eventually became the implicit association test. We had no idea that it would work as well as it did. In fact, had we had any conception that it would be as important as it was, I wouldn't have waited 2 years to write the computer program to implement it. The first test I tried was one in which I tried to demonstrate that people have positive associations with flowers and negative associations with insects. They're sitting at a computer keyboard. Actually, I was sitting at a computer keyboard. I was the very first subject in this program that I wrote, in which I had to give with my right hand responses to flower names and pleasant words, my left hand responses to insect names and unpleasant words. I did that task surprisingly rapidly. It was just tremendously easy. And then the program reversed the task for me, in which I had to respond to flower names and unpleasant words with my right hand mm-hmm. and insect names and pleasant words with my left hand. And I went into slow motion.
Mm-hmm.
I did this task, I made some errors, went slowly, and I figured, oh, okay, this is an unfamiliar task, and I just did a different task, which was so easy, I'll just do it again. And so I did it again, still slow. I said, okay, I just need to try to go faster at the task. I tried to go faster. I started making lots of errors. It was about this time that it dawned on me that, you know, maybe this was going to be the method mm-hmm. that we wanted.
Yes.
It slowed down responses by 0.3 seconds about. Now, that may not seem a lot, but in our research world of cognitive and social psychology, that's almost an eternity. People publish research studies in which they've demonstrated procedures that will slow down rapid responses that people are trying to make by 10 or 20 milliseconds. This is 3/10 of a second, 300 milliseconds. It was huge. After a month or so, I said, okay, is this going to work to do something that we want to measure? We want to measure attitudes and stereotypes that are related to biases, things that are now called implicit biases. And so I'll just do this same task again, only instead of flower names and insect names, I'll use names that we can classify as typically white American names and ones that we might classify as black American. And we know these names. We now do this test with face pictures, but at the time we didn't have the capability of presenting pictures. So Jamal, Leroy were black names. Brian or Michael were names that we had our subjects, or me at first, classify as white. And it's not that these names are always white or always black. It's just that people can easily categorize them this way. And, okay, long story short, exactly the same thing happened. And this was a surprise to me because it was telling me I had something in my head that I didn't know was there. I went slow when I was trying to give the same response to the black names and pleasant words. And I went fast when I was giving the same response to white names and pleasant words. I wouldn't have predicted that. I tried to repeat it again. I didn't get faster. And so this was the first version of what we now call the race attitude implicit association test. This is a test that's been completed 3 million or so times on our website.
And that
was really the start and the launch of a test that we started to tell our colleagues about, and now there's been huge amounts of research done with it.
And again, that website for the implicit association test is?
It's implicit.harvard.edu.
And we're speaking this morning with Tony Greenwald, co-author of Blind Spots, Hidden Biases of Good People. Our phone numbers are 503-231-8187. Take the test and see what your responses are and call us. Let's go to Michael, who's been waiting. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
First of all, I want to know how he would categorize the Bible and people that are born again Christians who is led not by the things of the world, but are led by spiritual things. In other words, Christians of certain persuasions, they have the Holy Spirit that tells them how to act and how to react in situations. So if you're conducting a test, in my mind, you're probably conducting it on people that are atheists, non-believers, and then you say good people with bad intentions, and according to the Bible, there are no good people.
Okay.
Okay. Wait. Hold off, because don't go away. Don't go away. We just need to cut it short. First, write down the website, because I want you to take the test and then post back what your results were. So let me give you the website, because you ask a very good question. Professor Greenwald, Tony Greenwald said, it is implicit.harvard.edu, and that's implicit.harvard.edu, in case folks can't get past my Midwest accent there.
And also there's a variety of tests, not only gender and race, but also religion.
And flowers and insects and children. So yeah, take the test, Michael, and hit us back. But Tony, an answer to his question.
Yeah, actually, I would say that the majority of people who have taken our test are probably religious people. America is, the United States of America is actually regarded as one of the countries that has the highest proportion of religious people, many of whom, of course, are Christians. Now, we do have a test on the website that measures liking, associating various religions, including, I think, Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, and Confucianism, I think.
Islam.
There are four of them, with pleasant. But this doesn't get to Michael's question.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the question, I don't think that our test is capable of getting to the mental phenomena that we would regard as spiritual, and at least I think it has potential to be used there, but it hasn't yet been used in research there.
And all right. Thank you for your call, Michael.
And we'll go to our next caller.
Oops. Good morning, Marie.
Yes, this is Marie. Good morning. Can
yes.
you all hear me all right?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. And I have a question for the guests, and what a wonderful program. I'm grateful. And here's my question. In working with people who have blind spots, and I'll give an example, what can we do? And, of course, I need to be aware of my own blind spots. We need to be aware of our own. But what can we do to help communicate when there is a blind spot? I'll give you a really interesting example. I was at Red Cross training. This was Oregon Red Cross training, and it's for a group. And speaking of churches, it was for groups providing shelter training for emergencies. For example, an earthquake in Hood River. I'm calling from Hood River. And when I was at the training, this is more than 12 months ago, I openly challenged the presenter. I raised my hand. I said, we have a dilemma here. The dilemma is that the Red Cross was presenting the water they would serve the people is in plastic bottles. Of course, we know that's commonly the economical solution nowadays, but I was challenging that here we are in Nestle land, or Nestle's trying to come into Cascade Locks and take their water, put it in plastic bottles. So I was challenging the Red Cross presenter. So that's an example of when there's blind spots, and luckily another environmental person rallied behind me and said, yes, we think this is a true issue. So how do we work when there are blind spots with important people like agencies, like a fundamental and renowned agency like the Red Cross? Any suggestions on that? And if you want, I'll just get off and hear your answer. I'll just get off the phone and listen, okay?
Okay.
Thank you for your call.
Okay, I'll take a shot at that. I think there are many situations in which when we're confronted with challenges in daily life, in the workplace, we take the sort of the built-in response, the response that's been traditionally established and widely used. And so you're talking about the, Marie's talking about the need to take into account environmental impact, and which would require stopping and thinking about how some well-established practice, in this case using plastic water bottles, over and perhaps overusing plastic, is counter to environmental motivation. And yes, it is necessary probably to have something that just says, okay, stop, think a moment, is this really what you want to do? And yes, challenging, raising those questions at a public meeting is probably a good way to try to set that in motion.
Thank you for your call, Marie. And so we've talked a lot about how to kind of recognize that we do have blind spots. We talked a little bit about the test and how you created it and how it works. I wanted to do two things before we wrap up. And one was to talk about people's responses to the results they get, and then how we can counterbalance those responses, both in ourselves and in our environment with the people we love and care and work with.
How might we reduce our hidden biases also?
A great question. And the associations that we measure, for example, the association of male with career, female with family, or male with science, female with non-scientific topics, these are very well established, and they're likely to intrude on judgments in many situations. And we think that, and we're especially concerned about workplace judgments that affect not only women, but also minorities in employment, promotion, merit judgment, and lots of things. And we think that the best advice that can be given is when you're making such judgments, try to leave subjectivity and discretion at the door. Don't think, you know, what do I want to do with this person? I know a lot about this person. How am I going to wrap this all up and make a judgment and come up, then you come up with something which is not, let's say, a mechanically arrived at decision. Whenever it's possible in the workplace, in making judgments about people, to base those judgments on objective information that you don't have to apply your discretion to, such as objective test scores, number of widgets produced, number of customers served, use that information and just make the fairest decision you can, and don't worry about the categories of people. Don't, you know, try to, and if you do that, the fact that it's a man or a woman or a black or a white or a Hispanic will not enter into the decision, mainly because you will have forced the decision to be made by other things.
How do you counter the fact that that assumes that there's a level of equality in terms of either skill or opportunity to apprehend a skill?
Well, I know that some people, and I might count myself among them, are inclined to think that, you know, we don't live in a society in which there's an exactly a level playing field. Some are at a disadvantage, and what I need to be doing is giving the benefit of the doubt to groups that are disadvantaged. That's one interpretation of affirmative action. I actually think that minorities and women are better served if people just try to make objectively accurate, justified decisions without worrying about disadvantage. The problem is that when people try to make the best decisions without using objective indicators or criteria, the decisions actually end up doing more damage to the women and minorities.
So in other words, if I'm hearing you correctly, we as human beings don't really have the tools or the mental processes available to really adequately assess or, quote-unquote, judge a person. It's just not within us.
Well, that's a little too strong a statement because, in fact, there are areas of expertise.
But I'm thinking in terms of, if I'm hearing you right, you're saying that the tests and processes we have cannot address and adjust for the fact that everybody doesn't have an equal opportunity to gain whatever skill or talent development or whatever. And so we can only say, well, I'm sorry, June, you just didn't add up your numbers as fast as Bob does. So Bob's going to get the job because, June, you just didn't add them up as fast.
Yeah. Well, in fact, if that judgment were made by actually seeing how fast June adds numbers up and how fast Bob adds numbers up, rather than making a judgment that might be done without that information, June is probably just as likely to come out on top as Bob. And in fact, although there's a long tradition of believing that women are relatively deficient in math skills, in fact, the gap in math, I mean, and there has long time been a gap in performance on math aptitudes tests favoring men, that gap is narrowing, and narrowing rapidly enough so that one might expect that it'll be gone maybe in less than a decade. And there are experiments done with this in which, I don't think I have time to get into that. But let's just say that the decision shouldn't be made by my thinking, is June going to do better than Bob, or just let's see how they do.
We have a couple of callers, so let's see if we can get to them before we end our program. And let's go to Bob.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Um, I didn't get the beginning part of the show, and I'm sorry about that, but I hope it will be up as a podcast before too long. Thank the professor for coming in. To piggyback on the conversation that just happened while I was listening, I think the question is more not can June add up faster than Bob or make more correct answers. Is it, if you have a skill set for a specific job, and Bob has been exposed to that skill set by virtue of being male and having experiences growing up fixing the car or doing physical labor or whatever, you know, would give him more background that would support this skill set, and June has not had those opportunities, is there any way to winnow out that effect besides having them both add up a column of numbers or put together a series of circuit boards or whatever the test is?
Well, not just that, Barth, but will June even get that opportunity? And one of the reasons it's interesting, my younger sister is a math teacher and a high-level math teacher, a graduate degree. And so there's a lot of assumptions not only about her ability to be a math teacher, but it was, you know, a fight because there are some folks who think that women shouldn't even be taught. So I'm trying to get at the whole system we have.
Okay. You've expanded that from my thinking, too. Thank you. My question, just a small aside from the professor's earlier discussion of his first test where he did right-handed white and good and left-handed black and bad and then reversed to white bad and black good.
And we have about 90 seconds.
I'll make this quick. My question just for the professor, and I'll take it off the air, is... I think that there's also a right-hand and a left-hand bias that's more than implicit in the society. And if you had started out with black and good on the right and white and bad on the on the left, and I'll leave it at that. You know, I'm sure you've
corrected
this over time.
Great question. Okay. And what if Professor is able, we'll have him back.
Respond to that briefly, if you're able to, in terms of right,
well,
left.
Well, that question... That question was a perfect scientist question, and does it make a difference if good is on the right, bad is on the left? And of course, we are scientists, so we actually did it the right way, and we randomized which side each is on. And there are some very small effects associated with which is on right and which is on left, but basically the test works pretty much the same way with either.
And for that test again, implicit.harvard.edu. Our guest this morning has been Tony Greenwald, co-author of Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People, published by Delacorte Press. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Yes, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Celeste and Cecil. I was very glad to visit.
You're listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. 90.7 here in the metro area. Stay tuned. We have coming up momentarily the Old Mole Variety Hour with news, views, and previews you can use.
Muertos Northwest invita al quinto anual celebración del Día de los Muertos, el sábado 2 de noviembre en Audio Cinema, desde la 1 de la tarde hasta la medianoche en 226 Sureste Calle Madison en Portland, debajo del puente Hawthorne. Celebrando la vida y la muerte, ayúdenos a traer los espíritus de tus queridos con su comida y bebida favorita. Y pues claro, bastante baile y alegría. Trae un artículo para agregar al altar comunitario. Habrá calaveras para decorar, artistas pintando caras al estilo muerto y también chocolatito y pan de muerto. Ven a escuchar el Mariachi Portland, Conjunto Alegre y Rafa de Alaska y su Deadliest Catch Band. Ven por los muertos y quédase a la comida, bebida y baile. Patrocinado en parte por KBOO, Tequila Cuervo y Cover Organ. Visita Facebook Muertos Northwest.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this October 28th Monday. Joe Clement is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, we'll talk minimum wage, revolutionary practice, capitalism, and board games, and eight girls taking pictures. We'll open this morning's show with Bill Riznick talking with Trish Kozla. She's an activist in the Fight for 15 movement, minimum wage college graduate worker, and she